Alrighty, hi. It's me again, even though I have a weird background and it doesn't look like me tonight, but I'm Lee Merritt. I'm your host, once an orthopedic surgeon, now a professional medical rebel. But anyway, I was going to talk about we're having this banking collapse and we should all be a little bit worried and get some cash in our hands, I think. But the banking collapse wouldn't hurt us if we had a form of local currency. Money's only to exchange hands for something that has real worth. Okay. And so tonight I've got Kristen Ragusan with me. She is the author of End of Scarcity. It's a book about how we can have local currencies do the work that we think we need a bank for, that we think we need the federal government for. And she's a professional wealth management person. She knows about crypto. So she's the perfect person to have here talk about this. So we'll be back in just a minute and we'll get into that. Thanks for joining us. Remember, use the code REBEL in the Brighteon store and we'll see you in just a minute.
The Brighteon store understands the importance of getting all the nutrients you need to support the healthy functions of your body. Our nutrient-dense superfoods and supplements can help nourish your body and promote your optimal health and well-being. 100% customer satisfaction guarantee on all purchases. You deserve the best. BrighteonStore.com. Support this amazing platform and amazing Patriots for Humanity.
Use promo code REBEL at checkout for additional savings.
Nearly all the vitamin C sold at retail today comes from China, and it's made from genetically modified corn. Even though vitamin C is a critical part of immune support, it's also critical to know where your vitamin C comes from. I'm Mike Adams, the founder of Brighteon and BrighteonStore.com, and we only sell non-China, non-GMO vitamin C. We then subject it to rigorous laboratory testing in our own food science lab, checking for heavy metals, glyphosate, as well as microbiological contamination. Only after it passes our tests do we encapsulate it and package it for our audience. You can find it at BrighteonStore.com. It's not the cheapest vitamin C on the market, but it is by far the most rigorously tested and honestly sourced vitamin C available anywhere in the world. Support your health and this free speech platform by shopping at BrighteonStore.com.
Well, thanks for joining us tonight, Kristen. And we had a discussion the other day. Well, we had a discussion down in Florida, I know too, about the ability for local areas to actually kind of produce their own script.
That's right.
Yeah. So how do we get out of this? Because this banking, first of all, maybe just review what's happening. Because this banking nightmare, it hasn't touched me locally, but I'm in a small town bank. You know, if you're not, is this just going to bail in the big banks? I hear that it's going to bother the small banks in that they're going to amortize the debt that's been created to all the banks, meaning they're going to take out the little banks because Bank of America or who is it, the SVB can't the FDI insurance doesn't cover all their multi-million dollar investors or bank clients. They're going to take it from us. Right. And that's going to be another problem. So what do you think? What's going on?
Yeah, no, I mean, it's really curious. I mean, number one, this is sort of always underlying the system. So just because it's coming to a head now, it's always the risk. And even since 2008, it's only gotten worse. You know, any of the regulation, anything they passed, still the precarious nature of this popping up at any time. So it's suspect in so many ways. And even just in the most practical way, we would worry that this easily puts the most pressure on community banks, credit unions, small banks, who make up probably about 50%, if not 75% of small business loans. I was just actually looking for the up-to-date percentage of that. So this is a really big issue. Small banks are the lifeline of real productivity. You know, there are really two kinds of bank loans that get written, and it didn't used to be this way, but since the 80s, it's accelerated in the sense that we would have productive investment capital loans, loans that were meant to go to farmers, to go to businesses, versus loans for consumption, basically mortgages. And the vast majority of loans that are written are for mortgages, hospital debt, college, some car loans, but the vast majority is mortgages. And so it never used to be this way. And so a lot of this lending becomes Ponzi lending because, you know, we even saw back in the early 2000s when we had the dot-com bust, Greenspan raised interest rates 17 times. You know, it's sort of, you forget about this, a quarter base, you know, 25 basis points per time. And it didn't slow the housing boom down because people believed they could make more on their house versus what the monthly payment was.
Right.
And that's where you get this constant boom and bust because the vast majority of lending is for consumer lending, which destroys capitalism because it's not going into businesses to produce bigger salaries. It's not going into the productive economy. It's going into things that are making college and housing more expensive, making the American dream less attainable and the entire system more dangerous.
Yeah, now, you know, I don't know a lot about this, but it seems to me that in the 1800s, one of the arguments for central banking and better oversight and control, just kind of like better oversight in medicine, right, is for safety and security. So that they had these runs on banks occasionally, but they were just individual banks. They were poorly managed banks, and they because a couple banks failed, then they decided they had to have a better system that they could control that. Is that my fair there, this is a failure of central planning ultimately?
Yeah, you know, this in fact, I mean, I think this one with Silicon Valley really started from interest rate mismanagement. And to some degree, you still could blame the Fed on this because they, I think, politically did not raise rates the first year the Biden administration came in to kind of support a good economy despite all the massive shutdowns that we had. And so already they should have, in theory, started to raise interest rates. I mean, we could even argue there really isn't any empirical data that raising interest rates, you know, stops inflation. It's actually kind of the opposite. It's like putting fuel on a burning house until it burns down, and then you say you put the fire out. But because they didn't come in and raise interest rates earlier, they were totally behind the game. And so then they had to come with guns blazing and raise, you know, much faster, much harder than they would have. So a lot of these banks, you know, if we give Silicon Valley the benefit of the doubt for the short term, they would have been investing in such a way with their capital that would have been, you know, not totally their fault, although the Fed has been clear saying it was going to continue to raise. They didn't mitigate the interest rate risk. And what happens when interest rates go up, the value of bonds or the value of the
right.
debt.
And they were in bonds.
Exactly. So it's like a seesaw, an inverse relationship. And then also the way the accounting rules were, they could get away for it a while until suddenly it looks like they're insolvent. And banks become insolvent from a ratio. It is still sort of important to get into that we're not dealing with the fractional reserve system anymore, which we all have been taught is the system we're on. And it's really a fairy tale at this point. What we're dealing with is that banks simply have a capital to asset ratio, meaning that their assets are the loans they write. The capital is how much padding they have in case the loans go bad. And the Bank of International Settlements in Switzerland sets that for the federal.
So fractional banking though means that they have to keep a percentage of their the deposits have to be in the bank. Okay. So that's not even on the books anymore.
No. That's sort of just a leftover, you know, something, right?
From your. So they could be doing this with nothing in the bank, essentially.
Yeah, they're all doing it with nothing in the bank. Yeah, absolutely.
Oh, they are doing it.
Yeah,
oh,
great, yeah. Great. You know, especially with Corona in 2020, all the banks, the reserve requirement went to zero, all of them. And, you know, Europe has had a zero requirement for a long time. A lot of the smaller banks, anything with 120, I think 4.2 million, something like that, has not had a reserve requirement for a long time. But, you know, big money center banks have had some type of reserve requirement in tiers. But again, these guys, you know, are the money dealers for the Fed. It's pretty darn easy for them to get their reserves. If they don't get them from depositors, if they don't get them from borrowing from each other's banks, they can go to the Fed's window and make the books look fine. So the concept that there even is 10% in the banks, we haven't been living that way for a long, long time.
Wow.
Yeah. You know,
and you know, it's just so it's completely artificial. It's the Politburo theory of finance. You know, a few guys make the rules that they think is going to work. And when they're wrong, they don't take the hit for it. What bothers me the most about this is that those of us who run small businesses that had problems because of government malfeasance and COVID, for example, when we got into, you know, and I had this problem, I ended up shutting down a business because at some point, don't throw good money after bad, you know, and I loved that little business, but it just wasn't worth my time. I'm not 30 anymore. I just couldn't spend long enough to make it pay. So the problem is that they don't ever have any liability when they make bad mistakes.
It's so much worse than it used to be. In the 30s, it was so much better, you know. So you think about it, even in the 30s when they had, you know, before the Great Depression and all the runs on the banks, it was isolated, relatively speaking, to the bank, in the sense that when the bank wrote a loan, they owned the loan, they held the loan, right?
Right.
And, you know, so if you had an institution who was irresponsible or just, you know, had a string of bad luck, you could let that bank fail and that bank would fail. And, you know, and also its customers, you know, really sort of honoring the sense of doing your work for capitalism and those kinds of things. And then, you know, because you had risk in the system, investment made sense. It wasn't, you know, I mean, when we make things where there is no risk, then all of capitalism breaks down because you're not being compensated to do your homework to make a proper investment, and society ends up breaking down. Today, you know, and I would really say, you know, we've had deflation for a long time, except for really now, where we're getting, you know, this is not even just sort of regular inflation. This inflation is pointing to a breakdown of the system. But for the last 30 years, we've had rates sort of perniciously going down. And that is a result of, you know, in the 80s, they consolidated the banking sector, and we had a real financialization of our capitalism. And what that means basically is that every company made money on creating the loan for their product rather than their product, you know?
Yeah. That's
and so they securitize these loans. So then when you look at it in the difference of the banking sector, when they would write these loans, they would sell them as quickly as possible. You know, it's still the minority of banks that actually maintain your mortgage or don't package up these loans and sell them. So we saw this in 2008 crisis, where if you said, all right, listen, we're going to let these huge banks fail, what good would it have done? You still would have wiped out the shareholders, but you also would have wiped out all of their capital. And where was their capital? You know, all these mortgages and then the leveraging of the mortgages, they were in our 401k plans and in our pension plans. So had they gone ahead and just let the too big to fail banks fail in the honor of capitalism, which has been so skewed at this point, you know, it really is corporatism slash fascism at this point, all of the retirement assets would have been defunct. So, you know, it's why are we at this point that we're securitizing everything? And it is sort of being driven, and securitizing meaning taking these loans, packaging them up as
right.
And then when you drive interest rates so low, right? So, you know, in 1975, interest rates were probably at 18%, you know, for a CD, certainly in the 80s. And then, you know, what a money market is still only paying 0.3 or 0.5%. Just recently, CD rates went up. But, you know, 2 or 3 years ago, CD rates were at 2%. To have $1 million invested in CDs, you made less than if you were on welfare and you're paying for people in welfare.
And you're not keeping up with inflation.
I
mean, I was told by somebody who has a regular job that said, if you don't make a 7% raise this year, you're behind the ball on inflation. And I think that's probably an underestimate, but yeah. So
purchasing power.
Yeah. So the whole thing though, with these banks, now, do you think this is, you know about crypto too. So do you think that this is tied to that
CBDC,
FTX or whatever it was, that the big collapse, you know, the start of the collapse of the crypto with that guy's kind of illicit money laundering of stuff?
Yeah, I mean, I think the worst
Friedman
Friedman with the FTX, Sam Bankman-Fried, you know, these names.
For Sam Bankman-Fried, yeah, thanks.
Quite entertaining, you know. And so when you look at FTX, you know, if we looked at it in the most suspicious of manners, you would say, wow, it really erodes people's trust in the idea of having your own wallet. It puts a lot of pressure on competition of different types of wallet issuers versus a centralized wallet issuer like the central banks. And that was such out and out fraud. That it's curious that it even got to the level that it got to. And then, you know, you look at Silicon Valley Bank, you look at Signature Bank, they're all sort of related to this crypto area, you know, which again is in a way ushering people into one single lane of choice, which of course is when bad things happen. And it's the opposite of our nature. So it can't be the solution, but we could be sort of shepherded to some type of solution.
That one single lane being the CBDC, the central banking digital currency.
Exactly.
Is that what it's called? Yeah.
Yeah, it's a CBDC. It's easy to central bank digital currency. You know, and in essence, our currencies have been digital for a long time. Why do we really need this? When we pull it apart and look at the story we're being told, it's for either inclusion, all these kinds of things that, again, I really don't believe or see the point. You know, the worry is that, of course, when the banking system, quote unquote, gets so unsafe, that the solution the government would have would be to bank directly with the central bank, and that everybody would have an account with the Fed.
And that's what the CBDC does, right? Essentially.
Yeah, you know, they haven't stated that we would have accounts with the Fed, but that's really what's being tossed around pretty repeatedly, you know, and that the Fed would never have to worry about capitalization and those kinds of things. Like, you know, like certainly the smaller banks have to worry. They're the ones who actually really need the support. So you get again this consolidation. It's sort of the same old story that we see over and over, you know, expanding the bubble, contracting the bubble, expanding the perception of wealth, squeezing the wealth, and we end up with feudalism, you know. So, but it's not where we have to stay. This is just the more I've looked at monetary history, this is the battle of the story, the saga of humanity for the past 5,000 years.
Right. So it looks to me like, I mean, the motive here is control. This looks to me like problem, reaction, solution, just like COVID. You get people, you create a problem, and then you get people to be afraid, and then they do things that are not in their own best interest, but they think they are for the benefit of security and safety. So in this case, you create the banking problem, and you know they control it all. So I'm sure that if they didn't want this, it wouldn't have happened. Nothing happens, as FDR said, nothing happens by chance. If it happens, you know it was planned that way. So they create the banking problem, so people are insecure. They don't, you know, and I've been noticing, it's interesting that in the last 7 days, gold has gone up $100 an ounce, but gold has had, somebody's had their finger on the gold market, so their central banks and their private investors could buy up, all the big guys could buy up gold at a song compared to what it should be.
That's right.
I don't know if that's ever going to escape, but in any case, we're all being made terrorized by these financial terrorists, the banksters, and then a lot of people are going to cry for help, and they're going to look at this digital currency that the Fed's going to hand out somehow. I see it as a big noose around our necks. There's no way I'm going to touch Fed Bitcoin or Fed Coin or whatever they want to call it. There's no way. I mean, we have to maintain cash. We have to maintain the ability to be anonymous when we buy things. Otherwise, it's social noose around our neck right there.
Yeah,
they don't like you, you can't buy something.
That's right. I mean, absolutely, the censorship will be tremendous there. But then, and also it will be linked to the climate change agenda, And there's a credit card in Sweden called Duconomy. I think it's Duconomy. And it basically, again, already is marking your carbon footprint and turns off your credit card based on someone's standard. And I believe that MasterCard is working with them to create something similar. So you can see it already on Amazon when you go and they'll say, oh, this is a carbon neutral company, or some brokerage house statements are putting at the bottom of their client statements their ESG score. So there definitely is some pushback, but we know how the system of whether you have access to your own money or not is going to be sold to the public. I absolutely do think gold and cash and all these other things assist us during breakdown. To build our new systems, we have to really go to the right consciousness of money. And, we really do have the opportunity to do it. And this is what our grandparents, our great grandparents knew. The really brave people of the 1800s fought so hard to get the money systems correct, but they didn't have the technology to prevail and ultimately lost. And sadly, even gold money, making gold singularly the money, was something that was used to take the power away from the people. When gold was bimetallic, silver and gold, there was plenty of money for people to do trade and expansion of the economy. And so certainly during periods of instability, these commodities help us. But when money is kept as scarce, so just like gold or Bitcoin, it might retain someone's value for a period of time. But when it gets used in transactions, the super wealthy powers that exist can just remove it out of the system. So let's say that Bitcoin continues to go up in price. Now, instead of creating a big to-do and trying to, ban it or deregulate or make it illegal, as soon as somebody used it for a coffee or to pay rent, it could be taken off out of circulation and in essence become defunct. And so this is really what happens to scarce commodities, diamonds, gold, oil, and are they really scarce? So they're a bridge, they're helpful, but they're not going to be the basis of how we ultimately break free of these systems.
Right. So, and I know when we come back, we're going to talk about your plan, how we actually get out of this. But I just want to ferret this out a little bit more. So Bitcoin, though, can be, because they don't sell it just by one coin anymore, you can buy something at a very low price. I guess maybe not coffee, because the transaction cost is too high. But for furniture or food or something like that, you could potentially do it. Just like people in Argentina, I read about the peso devaluation in Argentina. They would take their paycheck, they would go down to these gray market gold dealers, they would buy a gold chain, and then they would come back when they needed to buy food. They'd have a couple links cut off and take it in. So you can fractionate it somehow. You don't think that would work with Bitcoin or some coin? I'm not sold necessarily.
I mean, I think it'll help. Ultimately, it becomes, because it's value, and I think it still has tremendous value. The network is worth so much. The people who make the network work are completely in alignment with keeping it valid. So there's a lot to be said about Bitcoin, and I don't think it's going away by any means. And I'm like cheering its success on. I just don't really believe it's money.
It's just an investment.
Yeah, and it could be a store of value. Once the price stabilizes, it should be a legitimate store of value. That would be my best hope for it. But, you know, even though you would divide it into little tiny Satoshis, you know, that's what they're called.
I like that.
You know, and ultimately, there'll be 21 million in circulation. All of the Bitcoin will be mined by 2040. They'll all be in circulation. And every year, there's still less because, I mean, Fidelity just went to custodying for all retail customers. So people who don't want to mess with their own wallets and who still are comfortable having somebody else custody, they can go to Fidelity and Fidelity will do that for them right now. But, you know, still people today have been dying with the Bitcoin. It's like, you know, buried gold.
Right.
losing
their codes, losing their.
Yeah. And that's not hacking. So when people say, oh, the blockchain is unsafe. No, it's just, you know, you dropped your wallet at the corner, you know, and somebody decided to take it instead of give it back to you. So it really, Bitcoin has been safe in many ways, but just sort of misunderstood. But again, because there are only 21 million, if people with a lot of power decided that it shouldn't be in circulation anymore, they can easily get in on the other side of a transaction and just put it on the shelf, you know? So,
yeah, well, that's, you're right. That's what happened to gold and silver. And people hoarded it because they knew that when they brought out a cheaper currency, the cheaper currency gets left on the table and the people bring home the good stuff. Well, we'll be right back here in just a minute, but we're going to go to a commercial break. Don't forget to go to the Brighteon store, use the code REBEL, and we'll be back here in just a minute.
The global currency collapse will wipe out the dollar and many other assets, and the only things that will maintain value during the global debt reset are those with intrinsic value that do not require governments, corporations, or markets to make good on their obligations. At the top of this list of intrinsic assets is physical gold and silver. These precious metals have outlasted every failed civilization and government in human history, and they are non-digital, which means they still hold value even if the power grid fails. The Treasure Island Coins and Precious Metals Company is my go-to source for physical precious metals that are delivered securely and discreetly into your hands. Visit BrighteonMetals.com to check their live pricing and in-stock coins and bars. Find out why they are my trusted source for physical metals and why they're the official sponsor of Brighteon.tv. BrighteonMetals.com. At the Brighteon store, we offer a variety of colloidal silver solutions that we make in Texas using Texas rainwater and specialized circuitry that I personally designed to produce silver ions in purified rainwater. We have a colloidal silver extra strength spray, a silver-based first aid gel, as well as a colloidal silver herbal mouthwash solution that people just rave about. Each one of these is subjected to our rigorous laboratory testing for metals, glyphosate, and microbiology in order to ensure product purity and safety for your health. We manufacture our own silver products right in the heart of Texas and deliver them to you using our own warehousing and fulfillment infrastructure that we built to serve real America. All of us here at Brighteon thank you for your support. Shop our silver products at BrighteonStore.com.
Okay, we're back with Kristen Ragusan, and we're going to talk about how we get out of the mess of the banking system. And, you know, I used to call these guys the Uber Lords, but I've been dealing with parasites a lot, actual physical parasites, in teaching people how to get rid of them, all that sort of thing. It's on my website. But I've started calling them the Uber parasites because if that is really what they are. They're preying on us through this banking system. That's one way they prey on us. But this is how they suck the lifeblood out of our world, because the real worth of humanity is our labor. What we do is we produce things. These guys on the top don't produce anything. They just take our money, right? What are they producing? So What do you say? How do we get out of it now?
Yeah, and you know, there really truly is a way out of it that actually just, it'll feel a little foreign at the beginning, but it's age old and it's been done over and over every time people, you know, have broken out of it. It's what caused the Revolutionary War. So, you know, the problem is that what the banks are doing, they're rubber stamping our creditworthiness. So they've been given the proxy to do that. And in other civilizations, other generations, the people themselves decided the creditworthiness of someone else by what they produced. So there are a couple examples, but I think the first thing to even just start with is you know, when the founding fathers came to the United States, they were all in debt. And, you know, there just was not enough gold coins circulating in England. So they came here to start over, and they created colonial scrip, which we've sort of been told was highly inflationary, was paper money they just created. And that's really not true. The money that was issued represented farms. It was land banks. And so the amount of scrip that they put into circulation in the real economy was equal to the amount of productive land they had. And when they were ready to be more productive, they issued more scrip. And when there was too much, they extracted some. So they knew the age-old wisdom of money is that money should not be scarce to have value. That's actually the root of control. That money should be fluctuating in quantity and circulation to be equal to whatever the current productivity is of the people. And so they were able to do it.
Not to interrupt you, but why did it go down? We never had our population really go down. Then why did they take the money back? I would have thought they would have just expanded as we expanded, but what caused them to take money back?
You know, after this really was the true source of the Revolutionary War. You know, you can see even in the writings of the papers and through the banking associations, the British were saying the system that the colonists has is a system of mischief. You know, and it has to be stopped.
Well, they did it. The British took the money back.
The British took the money back.
Same thing as today then.
You know, and Hamilton really tried to again propel that. And so even through all the power of the few small colonists, the small percentage of the colonists that saw the vision of this country being a land for freedom and to honor all the contribution of all the people. So what the British and the French, you know, did at the same time, they brought tall ships to the Eastern seaboard with printing presses on them. And this was one of their major attacks during the war. So they counterfeited the colonial scrip or the continentals at that time as fast as they possibly could. And then they gave them away to people in the streets for pennies on the dollar. And so it didn't take long to figure out this is what was happening. So soon it was worth capital punishment if you were caught, you know, using that counterfeited money. And lo and behold, the colonists prevailed. So America was free probably until about 1812. And so then we started to get the concept of having a central bank coming through, and or before then even. But the bank was put out. And so England said, listen, either you put that bank back in or there's going to be war. And so I think there was some capitulation prior, but the communication was so slow that the War of 1812 started. The USS Constitution that's sitting in Boston Harbor, Old Ironsides fought in that war, you know, a wooden ship, but the cannons bounced off, and they burnt the White House down to the ground. Yeah. So, you know, and in 1812, the British banking system came back into place. So we started getting central banks that were owned by financiers, that this was the battle of Jackson and Jefferson wrote against it and all the rest, where people knew again that the creditworthiness of the people was not determining the loans or the creation of the money, but instead the financiers who could make loans or the investment very difficult. And primarily farmers were experiencing that. And many people say that this is what the Wizard of Oz is about, is that the farmers were fighting the witches of the East, Rockefeller, J.P. Morgan, and they would do all the hard labor, which, you know, our wealth is what gives money credit. Our wealth is our labor.
Our productivity.
Right? And it can't be separated from us. Yeah. So we've been so brainwashed and indoctrinated to believe that we have to get the money first to access our wealth, when our wealth is actually what gives money worth. And, right. and you know, so the farmers would get these loans from the financiers, and what would they do? There were no rules. So they would call the loan in right before the harvest. Right. So farmers, you know, would lose everything. And this led to the State Bank of North Dakota, where the farmers, and, you know, it was so funny because North Dakota is known to be such a conservative state. Then they were criticized saying, hey, you took this socialist idea. But they've been very protective of that bank and made sure that it was actually continuing to fund small business. So in North Dakota, with their perspective of understanding what that bank is for, that bank is for investment, productive investment, they have real investment capitalism, that bank functions there. But would that bank function in California? Would that bank function, you know, would it be supportive for universal basic income or other types of destruction of capitalism? My guess is yes. You know, so we have to come to the place where the people again are issuing alternative currencies off of their labor. And it's very easy to do. And there's a lot of evidence that it's beginning already.
Now, you know, this is a variant. A friend of mine who's Catholic said this is kind of like the Catholic Church. They issue, you know, if they use currency for their education system, you get their own little bonds or whatever they have. So you get points. And I don't remember exactly how it works, but he said it's an internal system, essentially. So, you know, once you buy into the system, then everything works on those credits.
Exactly. I mean, you could think of it like, you know, sort of, you know, a mall. I'm not sure how much malls exist or are thriving anymore, but still, you could go to a mall and get a gift certificate and it works at all the stores, right? And, you know, so then if you bought $100 and you owed someone $100, if they also enjoyed going to that mall, could you pay them back in that?
Yes.
Right.
And pretty soon you get off of the inflationary money that's being handed to you by the government, is what you're saying.
That's right.
Then I mean, it's because it doesn't help if you always have to go to the government and get their script to go and pay it in the mall. But if you were just internal, if that had all your things, then I could see how that works.
And this is the parallel system that needs to get activated, and it's completely legal. Alternative currencies are completely legal. And, you know, as it gets more advanced, there may be tax issues or those kinds of things. But even just beginning the exchange circles, you know, I think, of course, in funding farmers. Farmers are under attack, we know, from every which way. And, you know, if a farmer were to have issued last year, you know, a promise to deliver a certain amount of food, which really is a farm share, a CSA. And if I had, I don't know, 10 or 15 emails saying I could get a basket of food, and I was promised a certain amount of eggs, that money would have maintained its purchasing power. And so, you know, this is absolutely what all the people knew they knew in wildcat banking. You know, so wildcat banking sort of, again, gets smeared, has a terrible name, how nobody could trust the different script. It was issued in every single state. But of course, without technology, no one could prove it was legitimate when they moved away for geographically. And I have really this, you know, fantastic book, which, you know, you can actually see this stuff on the internet, but, they, you know, where they take all the script from, you know, the states, and it shows you all the different states. Like, you know, here is in Massachusetts, Gordon Pugh Fisheries issued their own script worth a certain amount of fish. You know, the leather factories in Lawrence worth a certain amount of boots and leather, and, you know, in Texas, ranchers. So every single state is in this book. And this was done because when the people knew that the money was too scarce, they understood that it was the wealth that they were creating with one another that actually made the money legitimate. And,
wow. You know, yeah. So
It's been done for eons, and now we have a chance to do it on a much more sophisticated level. And for those people who are afraid of the technology systems, it absolutely can still be done in paper. You know, just as we start to organize and support our local, or as you were saying, county communities, and this could work in tandem with state banks, but I fear for state banks without alternative local currencies, because by generating the money that you're using, that's how the people maintain that the government is really beholden to the people.
Yeah. And, you know, I didn't quite figure this all out like you've gone into the detail, but I've always wondered about when they talk about, oh, there's a big financial deficit with China and there's all those different things. You know, we are self-sufficient. If we just kind of stopped looking at how our money is rated by everybody else and look just within, even like you said, even with our own states, we're pretty self-sufficient. There are very few things that we can't produce, grow, you know, in our state. We're pretty self-sufficient. And my grandparents, they didn't go out of the state to shop. Everything was local. So that's what this brings us back to, is getting out of the big systems that are killing us here.
That's right. You know, I think the first concept, which is still sort of a mind-blowing one, is that wealth really, really, really is within us. You know, we're born with it. Every single person is born wealthy because you're born with talents and some kind of passion. And, you know, through the way life is created, it's easy to lose touch with whatever that passion is or that inspiration, but it really is inseparable. And, you know, I also argue that we're wired for altruism. And, you know, we get taught the Hobbesian theory of, you know, man eat the jungle. But, you know, scientists have shown that even when you witness an act of kindness, that your immune system produces hemoglobin B, is it? You know, more antibodies. And, you know, they did a test with monkeys once who were witnessing humans giving them treats. And they had two scientists there, and one scientist asked for help from the other scientist to open the jar, and the second scientist refused that to help, and the monkeys refused to take the treat from the scientist who wouldn't help. It was perceived as being antisocial, you know? Yeah. And then when you dig into Darwin actually, again, his work was hijacked. He was saying survival of the fittest was people who knew how to get along the best. And he talked about more the mechanics of love and connectivity. I think he talked about survival of the fittest like twice, you know.
Wow, David knows that.
David Lowe did a huge project called the Darwin Project, sort of putting that back into scope. So,
well, you know, and isn't it true? I mean, I read this somewhere. I can't verify it, but my understanding is that, to give the devil his due, that Hitler, the way he brought Germany out of the bad doldrums that they were in financially, is that he threw out the Rothschild banks and he backed the mark with German labor.
Yeah, yeah.
And suddenly, I mean, people don't realize how well they were doing. I mean, married couples got bonuses. If you had more kids, you got bonuses. You got a house at a you know, they gave you a stipend for a house. And I think there was even free houses that were given out at some point, but they really suddenly boomed and were able to recover very quickly because they got rid of the extraction mechanism, which is those central banks, and they backed with German labor.
Yeah, when you think of the Weimar Republic really fell because they owed loans due in other currencies.
Right.
And so when the United States issues its loans, it's payable in Federal Reserve notes, the proxy, you know, government dollar. So our loans are technically always payable. You know, it's questionable now where we have the shifting of the dollar, which again may be about bringing the central bank digital currency into our life. But you know, we're also taught that China, you know, that China owns the vast majority of our debt. You can see who owns the debt on treasury.gov, and you know, the last time I looked, I think China owns 7% of our debt. You know, so we own the vast majority of our debt. So if we did want to pay it off and do it slowly, or instead of saying, oh, you know, we have to bring taxes up to 70% or all these other kinds of things, we could do it. And, you know, you could also do it in a way where it created ridiculous inflation, but you could also do it in a way where it did not. And you just said, listen, we're choosing not to have the debt anymore. But instead, what I believe really should happen is that communities themselves need to begin to issue alternative currency for the promise to deliver a certain amount of product due in a specific period of time. And they only can issue as much currency by the supply that they have of whatever they produce, limited by the demand for it. And all of this will become transparent and provable on the blockchain, which I know some people are worried about. But we have to think of blockchain as just an accounting book. It's just a ledger, and anybody can see it. It's not changeable once an entry goes in. And so with the internet and with the blockchain, you can create a system of control and you also can create a system of liberation. So as long as there's choice, then people, you know, can have the true opportunity to democratize the creation of legitimate money. And money is legitimate when it's backed by what we produce. So you think about it today, how does money come into existence? 97% of it that we use in the real economy is bank credit. And that means when somebody goes to a bank and asks for a mortgage, the money doesn't exist. There's really no 10% in reserves. When you sign,
it's just electrons.
It is. It's just electrons. And it doesn't really come out of the air from nothing because it now is your burden as the borrower, right? So it's your promise to repay or have your property repossessed and your credit wrecked. That's what brings money into existence. And it comes on a ledger. So, you know, it's plus 500,000 on one side, minus 100,000 on the other. So like a head and tail of a quarter. And then when that money begins to circulate, we think it's money, but it's still really someone's debt. And so all the money that we're using, except for cash, 3% of the money in circulation is cash, and that's legitimate cash without debt. But the rest of it is actually truly someone's debt. And the big kicker is that when that debt is repaid, just like a yo-yo, the money itself is also extinguished because the money has no separate existence from the debt.
So one of the big issues here is there just isn't enough cash in circulation.
So they
did that purposely. They got rid of the $500 bills. They got rid of the $1,000 bills. They put capital controls on moving money across borders. So they've been squeezing this for a while.
And it's happening.
And they know what they're doing.
Yeah, I mean, the problem is that when you create money as mortgage debt, then all of society has to run as fast as they can on the hamster wheel. And the worst thing, what creates credit crises and what creates booms, and this is the difficulty now, even with the banks getting more hesitant, because that itself can create a credit crisis, because you need the constant expansion of credit.
Right.
So even in 2008, when they said banks were irresponsible, well, yeah, but if they weren't, we would have already had a credit crisis earlier, because you have to borrow, repay, right? And then you have to have this overconsumption and jobs become degradation of life rather than work and vocation, because everybody is enslaved
right.
by the system of using debt for money. So what all the brilliant people in history knew is that money should be credit. Now we think of credit cards, but no, it should be the promise to deliver something productive. And so when these systems get more sophisticated, they will still look like dollars in our wallet. But instead, I also believe, and this is totally hypothetical at this point, I believe Amazon will issue the money, Apple will issue the money, Toyota. And, you know, I've had some people say to me, oh, gosh, you know, you can't suggest that Amazon is going to issue the money. But if they do it correctly, they actually become very good citizens in society. So, you know, if Apple were to issue money worth a certain amount of Apple product and they issued too little relative to the demand for their product, the people who had the credit would have Apple's profit. So they would have to issue more money so that there was always enough flowing relative to the real productivity they had. If they issued too much, the credit would fall in value. So it would behoove them to buy it back.
But how do they issue it? Just like, okay, so I don't, I want to get into this new Apple Amazon system. They just going to give me script? I mean, what do I have to do to get the script?
Yeah, it would be on the market. So
I have to do some work, or I have to pay other money.
Yeah, I mean, you would exchange Federal Reserve notes for Apple dollars.
So the first line of this doesn't really make any help anybody, but the next generation, where you're just circulating the Apple dollars, or you know, hopefully somebody else's dollars, that would be then based on our work.
You know, it's exactly the same system, right? You know, it's just modernized. And there's no difference with what they did than this hypothetical example, except we would know if it was legitimate. And so Apple could pay their employees with Apple credit to begin with. Toyota could pay their suppliers, their employees in Toyota credit. The question is, would anybody accept it for payment? You know, so this is how every system starts. People accept Federal Reserve notes because we're required to pay income taxes in them. Otherwise, it might be questionable whether people would accept them or not, you know. And so credit cards almost...
In fact, most of us are not required to pay income taxes either. That's right. Go ahead.
Yeah, no, I know. Well, ironically, when the Federal Reserve started...
But that's why it was all...
year that the federal income tax also was made a law. So yes, it's highly connected. I mean, and even coin money started when kings had standing armies and they didn't know how to pay or take care of 100,000 men. So they started an income tax that was only payable in a scarce gold coin, which the people had to earn, but they could only earn it from the army because the army was paid with it. And so then the kings were able, through an income tax, to get their armies taken care of because the townspeople moved next to the armies to earn the coin. So income taxes are usually used to change behavior, keep the currency legitimate. And so now when we start to issue production-backed money, we create freedom and the power goes back to the people who are doing the work. But it's just very important that it starts in communities and with farmers. Then let businesses do it. Let cities and
right.
states. And it must be done with the people first.
And before we leave, how can people get a hold of you?
They can come to my website, which is either my name, Kristen Ragusin, it's KristenRagusin.com. And you can connect with me, find the book, join the community on Facebook, where people are coming together to do this, or the endofscarcity.com. The Getting the Book is a wonderful resource. It's the information I wish I could have had in the first grade. It's written to not
nice.
Really... You know, so that's the best place. This is the education that everybody should have gotten, you know, when we were 7 years old. And the book is written.
Well, thank you so much for coming on. And we'll see all you guys next week. Thanks for joining us. And don't forget to shop in the Brighteon store. Use the code REBEL. See you next week.